Good afternoon. My name is Ron Perry. I'm the Reference Services Manager here at the Main Library. And on behalf of our Library Director, Donna Nicely, I would like to welcome you all to the 4th Annual Thinking Out of the Lunchbox Series. Nashville's fortunate to have such an elegant public meeting facility, and we're also fortunate in Nashville to have a community partner like Vanderbilt. Not only do they provide us with informative and entertaining speakers, they also provide lunch. And I'd like to thank them for joining us here today. Before we begin, I need to go over a couple of housekeeping issues with you. First of all, if you park in the garage, and I know we were having some problems down there, so take your ticket to the information desk. You can have it validated there. The second thing, if you've got your cell phones, if you don't mind, turn them off so we can all enjoy the program. In case of emergencies, as you can see, there's plenty of exits to the left, the back of the room, and directly behind. There are also restrooms and water fountains directly behind us if you need those. And you should have had a flyer. Actually, you've got several flyers in your seats when you came. One of those contains information about our upcoming tribute to John Updike. There's going to be a series of Updike programs that kicks off today and will end with Mr. Updike himself coming to give a talk on November the 4th, which will be followed by a question and answer session and a book signing. That talk will begin at 10 o'clock in the morning and will be in the auditorium directly behind us across the hall. And in case there is an overflow crowd, which there was last year for the David McCullough talk, there will be overflow so you can come in here and watch Mr. Updike on the screen. So please take a look at the programs we've got coming up, and if you've got a chance to come and join us for those. Finally, there's some copies of John Updike novels and nonfiction books outside the doorway here if you'd like to check those out before you leave. Now I'd like to turn the program over to the folks who make this all possible, and I want to introduce you to the Vice Chancellor for Public Affairs at Vanderbilt University. Would you welcome Mike Schoenfield?
Thank you, Ron, and good afternoon, everybody. This is the, as you know, the start of the 4th season of the Thinking Out of the Lunchbox series, and looking around the room, it's almost like a family reunion. I know so many of you keep coming back as much for the talk as for the lunch, at least I know, or maybe the other way around, depending on what it is. But today, you're in for a very special treat, because we have a back by popular demand repeat performer. And for those of you who were here for the start of this series, you will see a familiar face up at the table. And my colleague, Professor Wood, will get to that in just a second. But before I turn it over to Professor Wood, I wanted to just give a couple of promotional announcements for some coming attractions, which I'm pretty sure that many, if not all of you, will be very interested in. First off is on September 12th, the launch of the new season of the Chancellor's Lecture Series at Vanderbilt will take place with Niall Ferguson, who's many of you may know as a distinguished author, professor of international history, scholar of economic history, and a very provocative thinker on the both the past and present of the world around us today. That will be at on September 12th at the Ingram Hall at the Blair School of Music, starting at 5 o'clock for the reception and 6 o'clock for the lecture, and then shortly after that on September 21st. Our Inside Out of the Lunchbox series, which we do in partnership with the Tennessee Performing Arts Center, will kick off its new season with a program on the Nashville Opera production of Aida. And you will have an opportunity to hear from John Humes, who is the artistic director of the Nashville Opera, Joy Calico, who is an assistant professor of music at Vanderbilt and teaches and studies opera, and as is always the case with the TPAC programs, you will have a chance to actually hear the opera. So for those of you who, admittedly like me, whose only dose of opera sometimes is that little bit of during the lunch, Inside Out of the Lunchbox series, be sure to check that out. That, again, is Thursday, September 21st at War Memorial Auditorium, And there is information about both of those programs, either on your seat or outside or both. And finally, I would like to call your attention to a program that I know some of you have had taken advantage of over the years and also have heard a lot about, I'm sure, from your friends and neighbors, and that is the Vanderbilt Master of Liberal Arts and Science program, the MLAS program, which gives you the opportunity to earn a Vanderbilt master's degree and also to experience some of the most interesting, intriguing, and provocative professors at Vanderbilt University in a classroom setting. There is more information available on this yellow card, which I believe is on your seats, on the website too, and the Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Science, who is in charge of this wonderful program, Martin Rafasarda, is in the back, so I know he would be happy to take your information, questions, and application as well. And he may even check your test scores and GPA while he's at it. So with that as the a full plate and a whole lot more to come for the fall semester, I am again delighted to welcome you to this program, delighted to welcome you to our home away from home with our partners at the Nashville Public Library, and most especially delighted to introduce my friend and colleague, David Wood. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ron, and thank you, Mike. He said that with all the things he announced, you had a full plate. I'd just like to add one more thing. I don't know if there's any room on the plate. It's another of our Vanderbilt outreach ventures. And you should have a brochure or flyer. This is the National Forum on Christianity and the Environment. Do you have that?
Yes.
Okay. This is being held at the end of the month on Saturday, the 30th of September, and it's an effort on the part of some of us at Vanderbilt to get and help community Christian leaders talk about environmental questions. I know that some of you are interested in these issues, and we would be very happy if you'd share news of this event with your own churches or with your own pastors and see if they'd be interested in turning up, or if you yourself have a role within the Christian community. Please do take seriously the idea of registering for this. There's an email address on the front. I should say that we call this Christianity Environment, where we're going to start off with Christianity and we're going to move on to more interfaith discussions. Well, it's really wonderful seeing you all back again. And I want to start really by thanking the Central Library's Bruce Farrar for these last few years of his wit and wisdom. He always puts us at ease with his sense of humor, and we're sorry to see him go. Today, where'd he go? He went down to somewhere in Texas.
Houston,
yeah. We are really delighted, as Mike said, to welcome back the very first speaker of this series. When we kicked off Thinking Out of the Box in March 2002, Barney Gay was our man, speaking about joy in everyday life. In that literal sense, to those who were here then, was anyone here then? Anyone? Yeah, a few. To those of you, anyway, I guess Barney needs no introduction. Quite literally, but I can't resist just reminding you of some of his extraordinary achievements. He is Professor and Chair of Religious Studies at Vanderbilt. He's Professor of Psychiatry, Professor of Anthropology, and he's Director of a very imaginative and progressive and very active center at Vanderbilt called the Center for the Study of Religion and Culture. He's on the editorial board of the Journal of Ritual Studies, Journal of Applied Psychoanalytical Studies, and the American Academy of Religion. He's a faculty member of the St. Louis Psychoanalytic Institute. He was certified as in adult psychoanalysis in 1990. This is to say that Professor Gay is both a very serious academic. He's also a practicing psychoanalyst. So whenever I hear that word practicing psychoanalyst, I think, when you get it right, they tell me, you know. His book, Freud on Sublimation, Reconsiderations, published in 92 and won the Heinz Hartmann Award from the New York Psychoanalytic Institute. His other books include Reading Jung, Science, Psychology, and Religion, Understanding the Occult, Fragmentation and Repair of the Self, and before that, Freud on Ritual. The last book he wrote, I think, was, unless I'm missing one, it was called Joy and the Objects of Psychoanalysis. Professor Gay's research interests include psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, the psychodynamic study of culture, comparative history of religions, and the psychology of religion. And I think it's fair to say that he's got a growing interest in the relation between science and religion, being associated with the work of the Templeton Foundation. But his abiding interest, it seems to me, is in the wealth and texture and complex pleasures of our daily life. I will be as intrigued as you to hear what he says about John Updike, who of all American novelists surely most shares this interest. Follow me.
Thank you, David. It's good to be back here. One more handout, I think, is blue. And the blue handout is two pages. One has about 30 books by John Updike that I like very much. He's written 70, and I haven't read them all, so I guess I get half fee today. But those 30 are substantial, and in the question and answer period, I'd be happy to talk about them. The ones perhaps you haven't seen before is under Essays and Criticism, Self-Consciousness, and Memoir. Updike will be here in November, and if you have time, you might really enjoy that book. It is Updike talking about himself and giving you, in a sense, the history of how he came to be the writer he is. In about 20 minutes, I'll ask you to read along with me, probably silently, as I talk about the text. You'll see there's, at the bottom of the page there's a text, a short story, and on the back of the page, there's a longer text. I'll read those with you and then try to say why I think they illustrate today's theme. Today's theme is sexual wisdom in John Updike. I should define that, I suppose. So here it is. Sexual wisdom is an illusion based on a simple truth. The truth is that sexuality is one form of human joy and can offer sometimes a form of healing. The illusion is that that form of healing is sufficient and can answer all of one's needs. John Updike has offered an especially honest account of this illusion and its consequences, especially for women. One consequence is that sexuality becomes sexualization. David mentioned I'm a psychoanalyst. I'm afraid we use words like that. Sexualization as a simple formula, it is sex plus anger equals sexualization. I'll try to show this later in my talk. Updike was born in 1932 in Reading, Pennsylvania. He moved with his mother and father to a little town called Shillington when he was very young and lived there for 13 years. If you read his early books, you will recognize that that experience has prefigured almost all of his later writings. His mother was smart, educated, and perhaps as brilliant as her son. His father was a high school math teacher who did odd jobs to make the family stay together. They're really somewhat struggling, lower middle class family. In a TV interview, his mother was asked about John as a boy. And she responded to the interviewer with a ferocious comment, which is this: John was a luminous boy. A luminous boy. We all need mothers like that. John excelled in high school, was class valedictorian, went to Harvard, graduated summa cum laude. He was on the editorial board of the Harvard Lampoon, which is a very important source of American comic genius. He had an Oxford fellowship for a year in sketching, in drawing. He worked for the New Yorker, but at age 25, he decided he would not become a professional writer for a newspaper or a magazine. He would live by writing alone. In that year, he wrote his first book of poetry, The Carpenter Hen and Other Tame Creatures, and then the first novel appeared a year later, The Poorhouse Fair, in 1959. He got a Guggenheim Fellowship, and using it, he wrote the first of the great rabbit books, called Rabbit Run. I'll cite from that book in a few minutes. He also won the National Book Award, 1932. He was the youngest person ever elected to the National Institute of Arts and Letters. In 81, he won the Pulitzer Prize for Rabbit is Rich. In 1990, he won a second Pulitzer Prize for Rabbit at Rest, the last book in the four-book series. In 1997, he won the Campion Award for being a, quote, distinguished Christian person of letters, and he also won the National Medal of Art and the National Medal for Humanities. In the meantime, writing, as I mentioned, 70 books. He's a prolific author. He is still writing, and when he comes here in November, I bet he'll be working on a manuscript. Updike's mother, who we just heard about, was a ferocious protector of her son. This comes through in a story about Updike, the boy, at about age 6. He had psoriasis as a young lad, and he reports this experience in grade school. In the second grade, perhaps it was, the teacher, standing above our obedient rows, rummaged in my hair and said aloud, "Good heavens, child, what's this on your head?" I can hear these words breaking into the air above me and see my mother's face when, that afternoon, I recounted them to her, probably with tears. And this is the part I like. Her eyes took on a fanatic glare. And the next morning, like an arrow that has fixed her course, she went to the school to have it out with the teacher who had heightened her defective cub's embarrassment. Great Updike piece. Although labeled a progressive and iconoclast, Updike holds onto his boyhood memories deeply and completely and fully. He is not politically or intellectually given to change, especially if it's driven by popular demand. For example, he was branded 4F in the 60s because of psoriasis, but he did not go against the Vietnam War. People of my generation may remember it was a staple that people of the center and left were against the war, but not Updike. This is what he says about it. He says, "My undovishness, like my battered and vestigial but unsurrendered Christianity, constituted a refusal to give up, to deny and disown my deepest and most fruitful self, my Shillington self, dimes for war stamps, nickels for the Sunday school, my cartoons, and big little books." Updike compares his boyhood religion to the urbane, humane world of universities like Harvard and Chicago and Vanderbilt, where if there's religion, it is generous, clear, and universal. It is like the Center for the Study of Religion and Culture, in fact. His father-in-law was a Unitarian minister who did quite well not affirming the divinity of Christ. About his father-in-law, Updike says this, "I loved him, and Unitarianism too. It lacked that greasy heaviness of Lutheranism, the gloom of its linoleum-floored Sunday school basements." He goes on. "And the sickly, milky tints of its stained glass windows, the thick yellow sheen of its varnished pews and altar furniture. Unitarianism seemed instead all air and light and good humor. It was classy and friendly. But he didn't join it." That's a wonderful Updike honesty about that. My Lutheran friends say, indeed, that's how they do Lutheranism in Pennsylvania. Why not? And I think the answer is already given. Because the thick yellow sheen of its varnished pews matter. Because it's his memory. It's his boyhood self. It is his Shillington self. And from that self, he derives all of his energy and all of his creativity. A similar tenacity marks his hold on Christianity, on, I would call it, folk traditional Christian beliefs. For example, he says this, "Those who scoff at the Christian hope of an afterlife have on their side not only a mass of biological evidence knitting the self-conscious mind tight to the perishing body, but a certain moral superiority as well. Isn't it terribly, well, selfish and grotesquely egocentric to hope for more than our animal walk in the sun, from eager blind infancy through the productive years into a senescence that, by the laws of biological instinct as well as by the premeditated precepts of Stoic virtue, will submit to eternal sleep gratefully?" His answer is, tough luck. It's exactly what he believes. So here's a remarkable, urbane, world-renowned intellectual who at the very same time affirms beliefs that do not typically dominate elite universities. Wisdom. What is wisdom, you're asking? Wisdom is the ability to discern how to live the good life. And people have had wisdom for probably 100,000 years. Every religious tradition has a strand called wisdom. The Hebrew Bible has wisdom literature, so does the Christian New Testament. You may remember the Serenity Prayer by the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. "God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference." It's a lovely definition of wisdom. What's the difference? And a wise person, a man or a woman, has accumulated the ability to make those discernments quite apart from science. In the Hebrew Bible, for example, wisdom literature includes Psalms, also a book of Job, written about 800 BCE, and of course, Ecclesiasticus, written about 300 BCE. In the Psalms, I'll just cite one of them. We have, for example, the 25th. "Show me your ways, O Lord, teach me your path. Guide me in your truth and teach me, for you are God, my Savior, and my hope is in you all day long." End quote. That heartfelt yearning, which is universally available in religious tradition, simply says, wisdom requires me to make these distinctions, and in prayer, the call goes out to God. The book of Job, as you recall, begins with a similar plea when Job, a good man, in every possible way, living the law, is crushed by a series of terrible events, including the death of his children, from which most of us would not survive. And Job calls on Yahweh to explain what happened. Why has this occurred to me since I have fulfilled all the laws and obeyed all your commandments? The response from Yahweh that in the book is about wisdom. Yahweh declares that he is a wise maker. The Greek would be Sophia. That he knows, Yahweh says, the inner experience of each creature, from lion cub to human being. This is from line 36. "Who," Yahweh says, "who has put wisdom in the inward parts? Or who has given understanding to the mind? Who can number the clouds by wisdom? Or who can pour the bottles of the sky when the dust runs into a mass and clods of earth stick together? Can you hunt the prey for the lioness, or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens and lie in wait in the thicket? Who provides for the raven his prey when his young ones cry to God in wonder for lack of food?" It's a gorgeous insight about this sense of wisdom being empathically grounded on knowing these kinds of distinctions. Christian authors who follow, of course, upon Judaism and grow out of Judaism have thousands of similar passages. I'll simply name one from Matthew. You could pick any scripture and find similar passages. This is one favorite chapter from Matthew chapter 7. Jesus is talking to his disciples. Ask, and it will be given you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened unto you. That notion of religious instruction is a feeling that somebody will tell me how to discern and live my life, and it will be done so in relationship. Now we go back to Rabbit. Rabbit is the nickname of Harry Angstrom, the first in the character we meet in Rabbit Run in 1960. He's a young man, he's about 26. He is falling into all kinds of anxiety. This is middle America, 1960. He's married to a woman named Janice. They have one child. Janice has a very real drinking problem. The scene opens here where Harry has come back, Rabbit has come back, trying to sell Magi Peelers. Magi Peelers are not very good chicken, junk rather, from a kitchen where he's trying to make housewives pay him an extraordinary amount of money to buy these objects. He hasn't sold many, and he's in very much a funk. He goes home, and Janice is watching a daytime TV show to identify people of my generation. I'll name the first names of the people on this television show. They are Annette, Tommy, Darlene, Cheryl, Bobby, Doreen, Lonnie, and Sharon. All right? What's the show? Okay, smarty pants. Who were the Mice-Keteers? That's right. Okay, who was the Moose-Keteer? Who said Roy? Roy is excellent. Precisely. Rabbit watches the show with Janice, his wife, and they see Jimmy, who was the chief musketeer, for those who don't enjoy this education, who offers a bit of wisdom right on the musketeers. And the wisdom is this. He cites the ancient Greek proverb that philosophers know thyself. And he says to the audience, now what does this mean, boys and girls? It means be who you are. Now, you could ask, what links mice, Jimmy, and Greek wisdom literature? Well, Updike does. Because this lovely passage in Rabbit Run, which is one of 100 such passages in that chapter alone, is Updike's deep sympathy for his characters, Janice and Rabbit, trying to figure out how the hell to live their lives. They don't know. They're in profound despair. Updike continues. Janice and Rabbit become unnaturally still. Both are Christians. God's name makes them feel guilty. Jimmy says, God wants some of us to become scientists, some of us to become artists, some of us to become firemen and doctors and trapeze artists. That seems unlikely. But, Jimmy continues, and he gives to each of us the special talents to become these things, provided that we work to develop them. We must work, boys and girls. So, know thyself. Learn to understand your talents, and then work to develop them. That's the way to be happy. That's the way to be happy. I like that passage because of its deep understanding that even from television, you see this effort to get to wisdom in these two young, confused people who will have a profound tragedy in the middle of that book deal with it. Let's talk about sex instead of philosophy. The joy of sexual union, especially in procreation, does not capture Updike's imagination. All of his characters have children. And children are an important part of these novels, but you don't, as I read him, find that to be the focus. Updike, the man, knows all about having children. He's a devoted father himself. But Updike the artist focuses upon a larger, anxious topic. Updike's male characters are estranged from the simple and profound joys of fecundity and procreation, from the natural joy, we might say, of parenthood and even grandparenthood. These joys occur for others, especially for women. Lacking access to them, Updike's male characters fall either into anger or resentment, or align themselves with nature, seeking there a form of pattern, if not wisdom. Sexualization will occur, I think you'll see in the passages in a minute, when men find themselves failing to be sustained by the sexual illusion. By seeking sexual conquest, they think they can find permanency and union. And when they cannot, a certain kind of tragedy ensues. For young people, especially young men, sexual desire can dominate every part of life, making every ordinary moment extraordinary, every little failure tolerable, every defeat trivial. When desire is in full control, when it seems that the body and mind yearn for the same almost available object, it puts fears of discontinuity, that is death, far away. My sense of who I am begins in my body. For heterosexual men, it extends to the mystery and allure, the absolute power of the female body to organize or disorganize us. I refer to high school. That yearning, pull, tug toward the female body, its panoply of textures, curves, delights, taste, inner spaces, an infinite variety of expressions on the female face, tugs me. It pulls me across the chasm that separates the outside world and me. When present, it is glorious and analgesic. It generates moments, I think, of intense gratitude. Sexuality and sexual contact can become sexualized, that is, turned into antidepressants, when they become total answers to living and to facing the problems of loss, aging, and death. Searching for sexual wisdom requires one to idealize the female body, to imagine that it alone can dissolve my anxieties and my sorrows. Religiously, sexualization is a form of idolatry. True to his task, Updike illuminates how a barely hidden rage underlies sexualization. And there's the first passage on your blue sheet. A paragraph from a short story about a professor named Dr. Morrison. This is the passage. Though he had written a notable monograph or two, and with a colleague now dead, a general account of the Austrian Empire, still considered standard, the revolutionary thesis, the sweeping and unifying insight that would have forever pinned his name to history's turning wheel, had never come to him. As a young assistant professor, he had felt it well within his grasp, a little more study, a sabbatical spent in inspired scribbling at his desk, and he would have it, one of those radical perceptions that, in hindsight, loom as inevitable as those of a Weber or a Burckhardt. The possibility had been there, fair as a willing young woman, and he failed to nail it. That is a very honest passage. It says exactly, at that moment, what sexualization is. It's nailing somebody, in this case a young woman, or nailing his fame to raise himself to the heights of Weber and Burckhardt. The passage continues, and I'll read this. You don't have it on there. What was missing? Sex, Morrison thought, as the day wore on. Sex was what had slid away. Not the fact of it. His young wife, though she needed her sleep, was less fussily obliging than any woman of Morrison's generation would have been. But the hope, the expectancy that used to draw all days and hours to a point. In his untenured years, he would look forward all day to a dinner party, to seeing Mrs. R, or a combative Miss V, for the languorous Madame de la Elle of the Department of Romance Languages in a silk or satin party dress. In watching the skins of such females flush and their gestures widen under the influence of drink and food and what the raucous and what the behavioral scientists call socialization, and hearing their voices rise and grow admirably raucous and reckless, that's what he missed. The air then was full of signs, of meanings, of flashing immaterial knives. Now, at dinner parties, he would sit and be amazed that there was not one woman at the table he wanted to sleep with. It was a kind of deafness, a turning down on the sound of a television set. The mouths around the table moved absurdly, like the mouths of fish. When this magical power of sexuality, the power to link the self with others and to answer anxiety, is lost, the result is despair, and sometimes a severe and deep depression. It's like a marriage turned bad. It's exhausting and debilitating. Seeing that passion rekindled in another person, in another man, as in the story you're going to read in a minute, evokes murder. And I'll ask you to turn to that now. This is from a short story called The Other Woman. Ed Marston awoke in the night to urinate, and as he groped his way back to the bed, the moonlight picked out a strange flash of white paper in his wife's top bureau drawer, which she had not quite closed. This drawer, he knew from 22 years of cohabitation, Carol devoted to her under things in a small stack of folded headscarves over on the left. Let me comment. A middle-aged man, Ed, has his plumbing not fully working correctly. That alone is a problem. He remembers, in other words, being a young man. Tolstoy says when he was a young man, he could plow the fields all day and then go write War and Peace at night. That kind of vitality is gone from Ed Marston. Why would Ed, by the way, find this strange flash of paper important? If you think about this little story, you would ask why in the middle of the night anyone would look around a bedroom and notice this tiny little clue. The answer, of course, is because he's looking. He is the detective. A crime has been committed. Quote, paper belonged in her desk downstairs or on the hall table where she usually left the day's mail. She was breathing steadily, obliviously, like an invisible ocean in the dark, not 10 feet away. The comment here, paper belongs in another location, not here. Something is out of joint. The mystery deepens. Something is wrong with his wife's underthings. Something alien nestles among them. The text says, with two fingers extended in a pincer, taking care not to rustle, Ed extracted the paper out from under the top scarf and crept back into the bathroom. He shut the door, turned on the light, and sat on the closed toilet seat. As he unfolded the concealed document, his hands were, more than trembling, jumping. Well, why is he excited? Why this deep excitement, this jumping, eroticized encounter with a piece of paper? The text goes on. It was a homemade valentine to her from the husband of a couple they knew, a pleasant, bland couple he had never much noticed on the politer fringes of their acquaintanceship. Yet the valentine had been flamboyantly penned and phrased with a ceremonious ardor, its short text encircled by a large heart in red ink, a heart which the writer reassured the receiver was even bigger this year than last. Homemade means something made with ardor of childhood and adolescence. It's from the period of time when Ed or Rabbit were young men, when death seems far away, when your plumbing works just fine, when, as the Professor Morrison put it, the world is dominated by the possibility of sex, when the day and the night are drawn towards that conquest, that process is available to you as a kind of lure. Ed doesn't have that, but the man down the street does. A weapon. Where does a weapon come from in the Bible? It comes from this rage. A weapon had been placed in Ed's hands. He reread the missive more than once, and in his nervous excitement, had to lift up the seat and urinate again. This is a very accurate physiological rendition. That all parents of boys and perhaps men will recognize. Without any instruction or training, boys learn that grasping hard at the penis, even at an early age, is somehow soothing. It's comforting to know that it's there, safe, and still firmly attached, and that one can feel it both externally by one's hand and internally, the penis itself. Yes, yes, it says, you're okay. Also, I'm okay too. I am fine, and so are you. Ed is bursting with pleasure, I would say, but it's not this time semen or sexuality or arousal, it's rage. It's narcissistic rage. He has not only been displaced by this bland guy down the road, but this man down the road has in his life the eroticized encounter that Ed no longer enjoys. This is the text. He switched off the bathroom light. The moonstruck snow outside the window seemed to leap bluely toward him, into him, with its smooth and expansive curves of coldness, its patches of shadow and glare. He felt toweringly tall, as if his feet rested not on the bathroom floor, which had fallen away, but on the earth itself. His trustfully sleeping wife and her lover asleep in his house up the road, and that man's own wife and all their combined children were in his hands. This is a typical Updike lyricism. It's a gorgeous passage, I think, that poetically captures this moment in the middle of the night on a winter evening in New England. And it also denotes the cold heart that now is in Ed. It denotes his rage. He floats above the earth because he's like a being larger than any human man now. He is like a god. He can survey the entire scene. As Updike says, their fates rest with him. Still trembling, the text concludes, he refolded the valentine, sliding along beside the bed toward the bureau in its slanted moonlight. He soundlessly tucked it back into the drawer beneath the top silk scarf. Tomorrow, Carol might notice its slightly exposed position and rebuke herself, and thank God that it had not noticed. Not that she was much one for rebuking herself or thanking God. Like all of us, Updike has limitations. By focusing so intently upon his experience, his Shillington self, as he put it, his boyhood, his memories, his Lutheranism, he can seem to exclude as worthy of attention the lives of others, of women, of non-white men, for example. But to be charitable, Updike never claims to be an author for every man or every woman. He has put his powers to good effect. For a lifetime of reflection, he attempts to tell the truth as he experiences it. Finally, Updike does not disdain his characters. No matter how self-centered we find Rabbit to be, Updike's care for his flawed characters, for his flawed human beings, comes through every time. He was once asked about his novels and their satire. Updike responded this way, "I'm not conscious of any piece of fiction of mine which is even the slightest taint of satirical attempt. You can't be satirical at the expense of fictional characters, because they're your creatures. You must only love them. And I think that once I set a character in motion, I did, to the best of my ability, try to love him and let his mind and his heart beat. This passage has nothing to do with sex. It has everything to do with wisdom. The great power of sexuality is its ability to draw us together, to form a union. In that sense, at its best, sexuality is grounded in love. Like satire, sexualization is steeped in anger and attack. The goal is to conquer and to triumph, to nail, to master the other. Her or his suffering momentarily addresses our long, unmet yearning for being seen, for being important, for being linked to them. If I cannot be joined through love, I can be united through fear. By evoking in us Ed's inner experience and his wish to harm Carol, Updike offers us a way back to our inner, denied, split-off selves. That is a gift of interior reconciliation, and it amounts to a kind of wisdom. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm going to open the floor to questions in a couple of minutes, but I think I'll just start us off with a kind of question. I guess you must have imagined might come your way, and that is, it goes something like this. Updike is you call him honest. A couple of times, and I think that's right, but I guess I'm wondering whether he isn't describing the world incredibly beautifully and with extraordinary richness and complexity and so on from a rather particular point of view. And I think you might want to say yes, it's the male point of view, but it's not necessarily even the male point of view. It might be a particular male point of view. And I'm just wondering if you were to start wondering whether, how general that was, whether wisdom really comes, whether we really get to wisdom in the end by reading Updike. One of his characters, Turnbull, in Toward the End of Time, talks about men and women. He says, we are condemned, men and women, to hostile symbiosis. Now, if you take that to be Updike's view, rather than just the view of his character, then you've got, as it were, a particular metaphysical or existential position that he's taking up. In other words, this is not the truth. This is Updike's view of the truth. And I'm wondering whether you have to, as it were, believe that in order to learn the kind of wisdom you think we can learn from Updike. You see the kind of question?
I do. one answer to this important question is that Updike self-consciously backs away from universities. I mentioned his interesting comments about his father-in-law, the Unitarian minister, whom he loved and respected. But Updike is not an intellectual in the professorial sense or the university sense. He doesn't do what I think David and I do. He is, to me, a very different creature who I, therefore, need. He's not like me, and he's probably not like you. He's like John Updike, as his mother said, a luminous boy. That is a limitation. It's certainly true. It's like musicians. A real musician, in some sense, is monomaniacal. They're not always eloquent about their music, or interesting, or interested in you, but the music matters. And Updike, in that sense, is an artist. He does not see himself as a spokesman or an advocate or a master of political theory. He doesn't offer himself as a kind of source of wisdom for how we should handle the oil crisis, or how we should handle men and women. I think he would always back away from that kind of demand. So in some sense, it doesn't answer your question, perhaps, David, but I think it may name one of his strengths. And his strength, again, to me, is this deep capacity to write from an internal libidinal experience. You can't write 70 new books in 50 years without some drive. And I think that drive in Updike comes from the deep sense he has that his experience matters. Now, that is highly individualized, and you could argue also narcissistic. I would defend him from that, but one could argue.
I'd be fascinated to know, but I'm not going to ask this question, just how women respond to Updike, whether they actually learn a lot about men from reading Updike, or learn a lot about some men, or the way some men are. But I think we should actually try and ask our audience for some.
We have 220 women here.
What we'll do is we'll ask, we'll get a bunch of questions for Wally to answer all together. So if you just ask your question, you'll make a few little notes, and then you'll try to come back to them all in a kind of clump.
I heard the joke this last week from my sisters that the mother's looking at her little boy and playing with the penis, and she says, "Mommy, is this my where my brain is?" She says, "Not yet, son." And I was thinking, after hearing about the magic of this ferment, that maybe you know what the question is. That they're. It may answer some needs. It kind of replicates what you said. I'd like you to comment on that in light of what women might already know about men.
Was this your sister, you said?
Huh?
Was this your sister who said this? Was this your sister?
Yeah, my sister said
it. You have a smart sister.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, Lenny.
I'm interested in knowing quite particularly not just the reaction of the women in this room or women in general, but what the reaction of Updike's wife. Or wives. I don't know how many he has.
Yes. Another lady here.
I'm curious to know, sir, if you go to his lectures and can be anonymous, what question would you have for Updike?
Yes.
You mentioned that Updike love is his character. And I'm wondering, why does he love rabbit?
Yeah, any more questions for our speaker? There's one at the back there. Mm-hmm. Gentlemen.
I wonder if you could explain, in terms of Updike's view of the world or whatever, the reaction of Ed Marston to this knowledge that he gets about his wife.
Yes, is that a lady a little bit further forward?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you've analyzed Updike and if he experiences joy.
Okay.
So do you think you have enough to be going on with?
Penis jokes. It gets a laugh by itself. You don't need any content. You have a very smart sister, and I should be pretty proud of her. She has a wonderful sense of humor about her little boy, which will help him, in my humble opinion, immeasurably through his life, the way Updike's mother helped John through his life. Updike was married twice. The first marriage ended after about 20 years. I think he had all his children with his first wife. It was a bad divorce, very painful to both. He writes about divorce relentlessly in his middle period, and they are powerful painful novels in which men are not great. As Updike says about himself, he is a Christian and completely open to his guilt and his inadequacies, which are, like mine, immense. And one of them may have been that first marriage did not work out. But I don't know about her. She was an artist and a very respected person in her own right. But I don't know otherwise. Question to Updike. I did have a question. I tried to get him to come here and give a long lecture on science and religion. He wrote me back a very beautiful, tight note saying no. So I'd ask him again. Why does he love Rabbit? Well, in part, he answered that question, because Rabbit is his creature. But Rabbit, obviously, like all artistic creations, comes from his own self, and to the degree that he can love himself and understand the boyhood he went through, he can love Rabbit. A Rabbit is not a heroic figure. And another reason I love the novels is I'm not either. It's not fantasy. It's not fairy tales. It isn't PR. It isn't science fiction. It isn't murder mysteries or drama. It's diagnostic dissection of a failed human being. And for those reasons, he won, I think, the Pulitzer Prize twice for this four-volume set on Rabbit and Rabbit's story. Why is Ed angry? Well, Ed is angry, I tried to say, because, like many men, he had once upon a time run his life like Professor Morrison had, namely by this sense of conquest, both of women, in this case, and his career. He was going to kill him, knock him dead, etc. I don't despise that. I think that's part of being a man, too, but Updike, the diagnostician, shows that when that's all there is, when, for example, Ed can talk about children that way, that these children, his own and the children of the other couple, are playthings, you recognize he's one sick bastard. It's an immense kind of cruelty. Now, Updike knows that. Updike, the man, knows that. He's not celebrating Ed, but part of his honesty, as David put it, part of Updike's zeal is to not hide these kinds of truths. And in doing that, he achieves a kind of art. Joy, I think Updike has had a wonderful life. He's been blessed, and he knows it. Thank you.